I want to welcome you to the March conference call for the HPVQI project. Deanna Koepka has invited a cancer survivor. And just a reminder that our April conference call will be delayed 1 week and will occur on April 11th at 7:30 in the morning. And that I would like for you to, if you have not already, sign in on the sign-in sheet, either through the link on the email that was sent to you yesterday or on the aapUtah.org website under resources and HPVQI project. Deanna, can you hear me now?
I can, yes.
Perfect. We're going to go ahead and turn the time over to you. Thank you for joining us this morning.
So thank you everyone so much for joining us today. We are really excited to have Robert Mock here from Arizona. I'm a little flipped around because I just got back from the International Human Papillomavirus meeting in Cape Town, South Africa. And what I'd like to just emphasize based on my experience at that conference is that now more than ever, improving HPV vaccination rates are so important. And especially in the United States and in a lot of other developing countries, one of the most important reasons for prioritizing this vaccine is the rise in HPV-related head and neck cancers. Robert Mock is going to talk to us about his experience as an HPV oral pharyngeal cancer survivor. First, I'm going to give you a little bit of background about him. He has worked in the healthcare industry for 30 years, and 27 of those years have been with GlaxoSmithKline. And as most of you know, GSK is the manufacturer of Cervarix, ironically. And while he was working in the vaccine division, he became keenly aware of HPV. In June of 2012, he was diagnosed with late-stage throat cancer due to the HPV virus. And today, he's very happy and proud to say that he is a survivor. His two-year battle made him realize just how precious life, family, and friends are to him. His life has been so negatively impacted by oral pharyngeal cancer that he now feels compelled to share his experience and elevate the awareness of this life-threatening virus and how we can prevent it. Over the past year, he has spoken to more than 100 parents about HPV vaccination and the virus, and it has been very obvious to him that most have very little knowledge and understanding of the impact the virus can have on themselves and their children. Therefore, his personal experience and healthcare industry background have influenced him to utilize his skill set to educate both parents and adolescents about HPV. So welcome, Robert. And just like with the last speaker that we invited, we are going to do this as an interview. And so first, Robert, would you like to just briefly say hello, and then we can jump into the questions?
Hello, everybody. Yes, Robert Mock. Thank you, Deanna. Appreciate the introduction. Yeah, it's really nice to be able to share the, what happened to me and the consequences, not just to me as an unfortunate victim of oral cancer, but related to HPV. But I think it goes beyond that. It goes into the family and what it does to the family. And it's just obviously very overwhelming, but at the same time, I'm truly blessed today to be able to sit here and talk to you folks. And so hopefully we'll get something out of this today, and that you'll be able to share with people out in the community that can make them more aware of from an educational standpoint of this horrible disease. But thank you, Deanna.
So just to emphasize that everyone on this call is a pediatrician or works in a pediatric practice. So, and they're involved in a project to improve HPV vaccination in their clinical practice. I'm just giving you just a few tips that we're just trying to frame this discussion on how pediatricians can improve the strength of their recommendation for the HPV vaccine and have some personal background on how this affects real people and real lives. So what was the first signs that you realized that something wasn't right, Robert, and you became concerned?
Yeah, I was in March of 2012, and I was on a ski trip with my kids and my family, and I was just sitting there with the family and around the fireplace, and in February, and my tongue could feel I could feel a little nodule in the left side of my throat. kind of in the back. I could actually touch it with my tongue. It was probably only about, I looked down with a flashlight, and it looked like maybe about a half a centimeter at that point. Pretty small, but just had me a little concerned. As Deanna said, I have 28 years background in healthcare. Worked for GSK and Cervarix. I sold many vaccines, many different disease states. And so I was keenly aware of my body, keenly aware of medical in terms of, you know, getting things checked out. I wasn't a person that avoids doctors, and I was not a person. I mean, I'm very vigilant with my health. You know, 6 months to my dentist. Every 6 months, doctor physicals every year. I mean, I've done that ever since, you know, day one. And I think a lot of that just had to do with my background in medical. But to get back to the question, it was just kind of peculiar. It was asymmetric. And as you guys know in healthcare, if something's asymmetric, you probably want to definitely get it looked at. So I didn't get into my doctor. You know how it is. Sometimes it's difficult. I didn't get in until it was probably about May I got in. And then that was to the family practice doctor. And then he transferred me over to the ENT doctor, which this gentleman here in Phoenix, unfortunately, totally misdiagnosed me. He gave me 21 days of ciprofloxacin and thought it was a cyst based on what he was seeing. And I'll be honest, folks, it looked like a simple fibroma or a papilloma, which it looked benign to look at it. And it wasn't discolored. It didn't have a lot of redness, whiteness. You know, it looked like a simple, benign fibroma. So, I understand how he could misdiagnose it. But after 21 days of Cipro, I went back to the ENT doctor, and he said, well, yeah, it's growing. And by now, you guys, it's like 2.5 centimeters. Okay, so we've tripled in size with a 21-day course of probably the most powerful antibiotic that a person could be given. So, I mean, I'm thinking to myself, just as common sense, you know, if it's growing, why would you even think about giving me another antibiotic? And that was his decision, to try another antibiotic. And I said, no, doctor, I know what, I used to sell antibiotics for many, many years, and I don't think that's the way to go. Let's get a biopsy immediately. And then what we will do is at that point make a decision on what direction we go. We said, well, I can't get you in the hospital. I can't get you in the biopsy. I can't get one for at least 2 weeks. I said, well, I'll take my services elsewhere. So I did that, and thank goodness I did, because I'm sitting here talking to you today. Otherwise, according to my second ENT doctor, Dr. Sam Bailey, wonderful guy. He had me see. I had a CT scan back in his office, radiology report. We had everything within 72 hours. That's how fast this gentleman moves. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just amazing, Deanna, because this is the way doctors should respond. They should never look at something in the throat and act as though, you know, 90% benign. Well, maybe. But you know what? There's that small percentage of chance that it's not. And if it's not, squamous cell cancer, as you guys know, it's aggressive. And mine was extremely aggressive. And it was moving fast. So I went to a new doctor, like I say, and Dr. Bailey just moved things along. He had me in the hospital doing a biopsy and pathology I was in there within 8 or 10 days. So now we're at May 30th, by the way, in terms of time frame, when I noticed it back in March. Now we're at May 30th, and I was in the hospital. And anyway, he said, okay, if it's active, then we're going to immediately do surgery. Well, unfortunately, I had a double whammy. It was positive, not just for squamous cell throat cancer, late stage, but I was also positive for thyroid cancer. So I had papillary carcinoma on top of the squamous cell carcinoma, which a couple of doctors I even see today, they say I haven't seen that ever in their 30 years of practice. But anyway, the good news is I had a thyroidectomy. I don't have a thyroid now. I had tonsillectomy. And I had pretty radical throat surgery. internally. That took a long time to heal. Immediately, we had to get rid of the thyroid cancer because you guys are familiar with the I-131 radioactive iodine treatment. They use that for thyroid, and so I had to do that first. And then we started chemo, radiation, 40 treatments of radiation, 5 rounds of chemo and cisplatin, which is the most horrible chemotherapy, I think, that's out there on the market. They're all horrible, but that's a pretty powerful one. And on top of that, they were giving me 200 milligram infusions versus the recommended dose is 100. So I was getting double the dose. I think a lot of that had to do with, you know, I was in good shape, 6'1", 184 pounds, former athlete, baseball player through college, kept myself in great shape, ate good, didn't abuse my body with cigarettes, alcohol, nothing. So, you know, I was not really the candidate you would think of to get throat cancer. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously it was related to HPV, you guys. So it was HPV strain number 16, and that was the one that got me. Now, the good news is, as you know, the prognosis for a oropharyngeal cancer patient, when they have HPV, is a little bit better than, say, somebody that's been a smoker their whole life. And that's well documented in the literature. So I was very optimistic, obviously scared. But when I woke up after at 5 o'clock in the afternoon after my surgery, it started at 7:30 in the morning, after, you know, anesthesia, et cetera, I woke up and I knew the worst had happened. He told me that could be a possibility. And so anyway, folks, it was, you know, pretty shocking and unfortunately impactful on the family. And I had to get a GI tube put in. I had to use that for a whole year. I was feeding myself through a tube. I went down to 138 pounds, 6'1", 138. That's a sight you probably can't even imagine in your mind. I never thought it was even possible for me to ever get to even below 150, much less 138. So today, I'm at 165 pounds. I'm 6'1", as I mentioned. I'm doing great. I have every 3 months I get my laryngoscopies by my ENT, who's wonderful. I'm in remission. I will get my cancer-free status, according to my oncology doctor, in August of this year. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, that's great. So what have been the long-term effects of these treatments? And also, how old were you when you were diagnosed? I think it's important for people to realize HPV takes a long time to manifest into cancer.
Yes, Deanna, I was, let's see, diagnosed 2012.
Approximately,
so
ballpark.
I was like, yeah, I was in my early 50s. You know, that's seems to be, you know, I mean, they say in the literature, right, it was anywhere between, I think it's 40 and 65. So I've read different mm-hmm. variations, but it's in that range is when it really manifests itself. I think some of that has to do with our immune system starts to break down as you get a little older. And I think, you know, stress contributes to that. I was working 70, 80 hour a week for GlaxoSmithKline, talking to people about HPV. Isn't that ironic? So I knew all about the virus, very well versed in it, and then go figure, I'm the one that had it. So now, you know, I'm out there and speaking about it because I have a good, solid understanding of the virus and what it creates. But then obviously, as a survivor, I think it's even more impactful for people, parents, you know, soccer field parents, you know, flag football parents, when I'm with my boy and my girl at her ballet recitals. I mean, I'm talking to everybody. And I don't mean I just blast them with HPV out of the gate. I mean, I'm talking to them in a mild manner about the CDC commercial or the Merck commercial. Did you see this? And next thing you know, we're in a conversation, and then they ask, why do you talk about HPV? And I said, well, I'm an HPV oral cancer survivor. And then their mouth their mouth drops. So anyway, but that's in a nutshell my story, folks. And be happy to answer any other questions.
Well, I think I was just wondering, how have these treatments affected your family life, or how did your diagnosis affect your family life and your social life with friends? What was the emotional toll of it on you?
Yeah, it was pretty challenging, and you know, I look back at it, and as I was going through the rigors of the radiation, the chemo, and I saw my body just dwindling to very, very thin. I mean, I looked like a war camp prisoner, World War II. And yeah, I was very scared. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, trying to keep a smile on my face for my children. My boy was 7 on my diagnosis, and my girl was 4. My little daughter, I just told her that Daddy had a little buggy, and the buggy was going to go away, and she understood that, I guess. And she wasn't, I don't think, as alarmed as my boy was. He knew the C word, and he understood all about it, because we had lost a really close friend to prostate cancer when he was 5, very close friend. And he saw our friend go down really fast. So he knew what that was all about. I just remember, and I tell this story because it's something that will be in my mind for the rest of my life. And it was July 27th of 2012, and I was at about 100, maybe 140 pounds, and still dropping weight at that time. And I was in a separate room, and my boy comes in about 3 o'clock in the morning. He lays next to me, and I had to prop myself up every night. I couldn't sleep flat because your saliva gets so thick, your mucus is so thick because of the radiation and what it's doing to your throat, that you can actually choke on your own mucus and crap that gets in your throat if you don't keep yourself propped up. Well, bless his heart, you know, he comes in and he brings me another pillow, and he said, "Daddy, you need to get higher because you're coughing all the time. I can hear you coughing, and I'm really scared." And I said, "Honey, you know what? Daddy's going to get through this. Don't you worry." And he says to me, "Daddy, are you sure you're going to be here for Tanya and me and Mommy?" And right then, I still remember that. It's like it was yesterday, and it was a really tough set of words that came out of his mouth for me. But I can tell you, when he said that to me, I really feel that was my higher power telling me, keep pushing, you're going to get through this. And I did just that. I mean, it gave me like an extra burst of energy and strength mentally to get through this rigorous ordeal. And it was a blessing for him to come in that room that night and cry and be worried. And, you know, it's just things happen in a very interesting way, and why they happen, we never really always understand it. But now, after the fact, I get it. You know, I understand why he came in that room that night and said what he said to me. As hard as it hurt, it gave me strength. So, you know, I'm doing good today. I still suffer from a lot of the side effects. I don't have any saliva. I have to drink, like right now I'm taking a sip of water so I can talk to you. But I have to I use a lot of coconut oil, which is a superfood, and I keep my pharyngeal area, I keep it lubricated with coconut oil in the morning, and I usually take it in the afternoon, like a couple of teaspoons. It really, really helps. But I drink a lot of water, probably a gallon, not more, a day, just so I can, you know, speak and people understand me versus my tongue getting stuck to the roof of my mouth. So I don't have saliva. I don't, I get a little fatigue, but that's all, I think, more related to my TSH, my thyroid stimulating hormone, gets out of whack sometimes because I lost my thyroid, which obviously is totally separate from throat cancer. But overall, you guys, I'm so blessed. My life is better today than it was pre-disease. And people say, how can you say that? Well, it's pretty simple. It's just I look at life totally different. anybody that's gone through cancer. I know everybody on this phone line today has either lost a loved one, has a loved one that fought cancer, or has a friend that fought cancer, or has a friend that passed of cancer. Doesn't matter what kind of cancer. Cancer is horrible. It takes the family in a spiral direction. But I know it's a long-winded answer, maybe, Deanna, but I think it just goes to show that the family is as much affected by the ordeal, if not more, I mean that, than the victim, because they're the ones that are having to go to school the next day and have to deal with it at their school in first and second and third grade. They're having to think about it every second. I'm propped up in a pillow, coughing, choking, trying to feed myself with a tube, but at the same time, I almost think it's harder on the family.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, Robert. I think you've done a fantastic job of really giving people on the call a feel for what you went through. Do you have one final comment for a message that you think pediatricians should be sharing with parents regarding HPV vaccination and HPV cancers?
I do. And, I think that the best way for me to describe, I've done probably over, 60 to 80 speaking engagements. I do a lot of work with dental hygiene students, schools, and I just did a talk not too long ago at Midwestern University for practicing dentists, dental school for dentists. One of the things I say to folks at the end, I said, if you have a parent that's resistant to getting their child vaccinated at 11 years of age, you know, they're going to get meningococcal, they're going to get the Tdap vaccine at that same age. Why not get the HPV? Now, this is not about sex. This is about cancer. My recommendation is let's don't even talk about the SEX word. We don't even need to mention that in the dialogue unless they want to get deep into a discussion. Then I guess you have to. Let's just say if this prevents six different types of cancer, and you would not want Johnny to come down with cancer of these six types ever in his or her life. What I would say is, and if that parent says, no, I just really don't want to do that, ask that parent this question. Do you get insurance on your home? Yes or no? Well, they're probably going to say yes. Excuse me, ma'am, do you get insurance on your car? Yes or no? They're hopefully going to say yes. Now, is Johnny worth an insurance policy that's free through the Vaccine for Children program? Free, a free insurance policy. How could you resist a free insurance policy against your son or your daughter ever getting cervical cancer, your son or daughter getting oropharyngeal cancer? And just see where they go with that one. So that would be my message. And that's what I tell parents today. I use that analogy. And you know what? I would say 90% of the time it works.
Nice. I haven't heard that one. And I've been around this for a while. Thanks so much. I really like your creative way of getting down to why parents need to prioritize this anti-cancer vaccine. So do we have any questions?
Thank you, Robert. And thank you, Deanna, for providing this opportunity for us to hear about your story.
We have one comment. Diane Liu, who's a pediatrician at the University of Utah, said she heard the story and it was wonderful.
Thank you. I appreciate that, folks.
Terrific. Thank you. We are going to now turn the time over to Dr. Diane Liu, and she's going to talk to us about PDSA cycles. Go ahead, Diane.
Good morning, Robert and Deanna. Thank you so much for that compelling experience. And I just want to first say that when we started this, Bill Cosgrove had invited us to remember that we would be able to save a life, that we could potentially save a life. And I think that sometimes in our everyday activities as pediatricians, we think of the immediate ability to save a life. But Robert, you've reminded us that our real goal is to help our children to grow into functional, healthy adults. And when you get there, we don't want to forget that there are things that we could have done in the childhood to prevent something as serious as cancer. So thank you again.
Oh, you're sure welcome.
I've been asked by Bill to just share a few things about our current status. Can you pull up my slides, or have you done that and I just didn't realize this? Okay, wonderful. Thank you, everyone. Well, I am just, I cannot actually see the slides, but I will just ask Elisa if you can then scroll through the slides that Dawn Bentley is our quality improvement coach and specialist from UPIC, and I'm the director of UPIC, and we are part of this collaborative effort to support you in your clinics and your clinic teams as you conduct your quality improvement effort. What I really appreciated about Bill's message to us at the very beginning is we're not trying to get mired down in some of the formalities of quality improvement. We just want to get out there and we want to improve. And so with that being said, I want to let you know that Dawn Bentley will be reaching out to your practice, whether it will be to you or someone that you identify that you're working with in your team, to follow up with you each month about how things are going. Before I launch into the data, I believe Bill will probably have to fill us in on that. I just wanted to remind us about some of the principles that we're trying to employ in our practice as we think about improving HPV work. It's just the slides that shows PDSA. So let me draw your attention to the right side, which is an image from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, IHI. And it is the model in which we employ for most of our collaborative efforts. So there are many different kinds of quality improvement models. We feel the model for improvement is the most succinct and clear for clinicians, while still maintaining some sense of integrity about holding ourselves accountable to a systematic process. The learner is asked three questions. What are we trying to accomplish? We're trying to improve our HPV vaccination rates. And then how will we know if an improvement occurs? So we need to decide what we're going to measure. And we decided HPV vaccine rate for 11 and 12-year-olds initiation. That was our measure. What changes can we make to result in an improvement? And that's when we launch into this whole cycle of let's test a change. Currently, we should all be in some form of PDSA cycle. And if you haven't really thought about it in this kind of framework, I would encourage you to think about it in this way. Every quality effort may require some form of project management, and this is something, a simple tool we're going to talk about that you may want to employ within your practice. So again, PDSA is short for Plan, Do, Study, Act. It's a modification of PDCA or Plan, Do, Check Act, and this was part of the assembly line sort of quality improvement science in past times, but we've adopted it to Plan, Do, Study, Act, in which you'll develop a plan to test your change. So sitting down with your team, or if it's you on your own or with you as peer colleagues, developing a plan, you're carrying out your test now, and formally observing and learning from the consequences is something that you might not actively be doing. I would encourage you to try. If you are doing it, we are going to be very interested in learning from and hearing from your observations, and then determining what modifications are needed to whatever change you've made, and then testing again. And this is really our action-oriented learning in employing the scientific method. Elisa, can you scroll to the last slide then? So if you can see, this is a worksheet that there are a number of open source PDSA type worksheets and templates. This one I just pulled off of IHI because we had used this for some of our HPV work at University Pediatrics. The Population Health Improvement Partners also has a PDSA template. The AAP may have one. I'm not sure if it's open source. I know they're using one for antibiotic stewardship work. We will make available to you, or if you decide you don't really want to use a sheet, Don will probably just give you a call and we may fill some things out. And what we'd like to do is collect information for Utah AAP chapter as we're moving along this project so that we can share ideas and understand what other practices are doing. I'm just going to walk you very quickly through the actual sheet and let you know what, you know, this is one cycle when we initiated our HPV work. So our aim, to improve HPV vaccine rates for children ages 11 to 12, presenting to clinic for any visit. So I think that was one of the great things about this collaborative as well. We're really focusing on any opportunity. We don't want to miss any opportunity. As we know, 11 and 12-year-olds come in very infrequently, so if we're only targeting well-child visits, it may not be the most fruitful opportunity. Every goal requires a small test of change. Our very first test of change was to employ provider prompts at all visits for our 11 and 12-year-old kiddos who come in. The MA has always been responsible for sort of printing out a vaccine record, and then what we call a provider prompt is highlighting what vaccines are due. And typically they do that within the time the patient is being roomed. Where it's done, they just highlight on the vaccine sheet. So what we decided we needed to do was to scrub the next day's chart before the end of the day, the day before, and include the vaccine sheet for all visits. The MAs would typically just scrub those charts and put the vaccine sheets in for well-child visits, all well-child visits. But we said, let's scrub the charts and include vaccine sheets for all visits for ages 11 to 12, so that they didn't have an increased load of having to do all the vaccine sheets for every single acute visit. We just had them do it for the 11 and 12-year-olds. And also we decided to, as part of this test of change, not just having that sheet scrubbed or the chart scrubbed for the next day, but making sure that there was a huddle with the provider. So for some of you might say, well, the huddle for the provider would be a separate PDSA. For us, we felt like this was, you know, a related event. So people responsible for scrubbing included the OSS and the MA for the next day's chart, and when would it be done, the night before or the day of, the morning of, depending on what makes sense for the workflow, and where it would be done is the clinic. Our prediction before was that physicians will have a decision support reminder so that they can provide the strong provider recommendation. Oftentimes in our busy days, we just may not think about our vaccine reminder for kiddos, especially if we don't have their vaccines in front of us and they're coming in for some, you know, something with their leg or some quick rash. But measures to determine if prediction succeeds. So technically, we could have developed a process measure, which would have said something like, for all 11, 12-year-olds coming in, was a vaccine sheet prompt completed, yes or no? And we could see if that was the case. We didn't actually decide to develop that process measure because we really wanted to just continue to look at the outcome of whether or not the vaccine was received. Now, what actually happened when we ran this test? So initially, it was a challenge to get the clinic individuals to sort of change their workflow, but that, you know, they had a long day, and trying to do that at the end of the day, especially when they're trying to clean up and get things finished for that particular day, was a little bit of a challenge. But since they were already in the habit of putting vaccine info for the next day's well-child visit, adding it on wasn't too much of a request. But that's something that's really important when we're thinking about our practice team and how they usually conduct their work. Also, the day of the huddles can be a hit or miss, depending on when I arrive to clinic. And certainly with my colleagues, not everyone actually does a huddle. It's not part of their cultural clinical workflow. So that was something that we noticed. For all the patients, since the numbers are actually pretty low for me, 100% of the time I did have the provider prompt. But I recognized that that did not automatically equate the patient uptake of the vaccines despite the provider recommendation. So I knew that this one test of change wasn't really getting me, despite the strong provider recommendation, to 100% vaccination. But it's getting me closer, so act. What modifications to the plan will be made? So currently we decided that we're not going to modify our provider prompt at this point. We've only had two cycles, and we have seen an improvement, but again, our numbers have been relatively low. So we went from 50% to 66%. So with that being said, that was one quick kind of encapsulated way in which our team was able to look at one test of change as it exists within the flow dynamics of clinic. So with that being said, Bill, if you can, would you mind sharing the aggregate data? I was not able to log in, so I wasn't able to include it in the slides today, but we will be including aggregate data in slide sets for the future.
Hey, this is Bill Cosgrove. So far, things are going well. All of our offices have entered data for January and February.
Great.
And I don't have a slide that shows the aggregate data, but as you guessed, about a third of the offices stayed the same, about a third had a small increase, and about a third had a small decrease. And that's kind of what we expect with any kind of process. There's some part of random chance gets involved. And so, first of all, if your office, when you look at your own data, if your curve went down a little bit, don't be discouraged. That's kind of normal variation. And also the ones who went up a little bit, don't get too celebratory because some of that is also random chance. But we do now have a process. We have your charts. You can look at those. You can kind of see where you're going. But the main thing is to use it as an impetus to make a change and try to improve some part of your process. If you take apart your process, there's probably 30 pieces of the process, from making the appointment for the scheduler to checking at the front desk for the MA to put them in the room, the doctor, the wrap up at the end of the visit. There's a lot of things that you could take a look at and try to improve. Now, over the course of the next 5 months or so, you're going to change several things. So the other part of this is try to keep accurate notes about what you tried and whether it worked. And you don't have to make a trial for the whole month. You just try it for a few days. If it seems to work, keep going. If it doesn't seem to work, you know, tweak it and change it and try again. This whole thing is really set up on two things. Take a look at your own results and then make a choice about what you want to do next. So, Diane, as far as the aggregate data, I think each office only can see their own data.
Right.
You and I can see the total data.
Correct. Well, I really appreciate having the chance to share some updated information with you and to keep sort of the methods or the tools and the principles of QI as we're conducting this work. And as Bill was saying, absolutely making tweaks, thinking about things. I think that's really where the focal point is. It's not to berate ourselves, but it is to celebrate together that we're actually making these efforts and to think about these principles, that these are founded in science. There's some systematic investigation that we're doing together as teams. And I just want to conclude by saying, please be ready for or expect a contact from Dawn. And it'll be brief. And if it's somebody in your office that you'd rather she speak with, please let us know. Thank you so much. And I'll turn the time back over to Bill and Alisa.
This is Bill Cosgrove again. Two things. Please try to keep track of it. There is a way on the key data system for you to annotate your records. And I have messed with that and have failed to get that to work. So I will check again with AAP and figure out how we each do that. And we'll send out an email so that you can keep kind of a running record in the database about what you've tried.
We're going to wrap up today and want to thank you again for joining us and remind you that if you have not already, to please sign in either through the email link or on the AAP website. Again, a reminder that our next call will be on Tuesday, April 11th at 7:30 in the morning. Thank you for joining us. Have a fabulous week.